and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 19th of March with me, Ian Welsh. Earlier this week, I caught up with Gotz Martin from palm oil giant Golden Agri Resources, a regular contributor to the podcast. We talked about the ongoing challenges for the sector, securing sustainable supply and working with producer communities. And there's also some news about Innovation Forum's Sustainable Apparel Barometer project. That's all to come. First, though, is some sustainable business news. There's a new report out from Greenpeace analysing the effectiveness of certification schemes as instruments to prevent deforestation and ecosystem conversion. As you would probably expect, there's no fence sitting, and the report's title, Destruction Certified, tells you pretty much all you need to know. The headline conclusion is that certification is a weak tool to address global deforestation. Why? Well, again, no real surprises. Greenpeace says the culprits are weak implementation combined with a lack of transparency and product traceability. Certified companies are linked with deforestation, ecosystem destruction, and land disputes, including violating indigenous people's rights. Greenpeace accuses certification schemes of essentially greenwashing, providing a veneer of apparent responsibility to destructive companies. There has been immediate pushback from the big certification schemes. The best known, the Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC, issued a statement intending, it says, to clarify misconceptions in the Greenpeace report. There's a strong denial of greenwashing and a point-by-point rebuttal of some of the report's principal allegations. FSC does say that it wants to learn from criticism and pledges to use the Greenpeace report as a basis for further learning and improvement. For more on the thinking behind the Destruction Certified report, do check out a podcast my colleague Toby Webb recorded with Greenpeace forest campaigner Grant Rosamond, one of the report's authors. It's published now on the Innovation Forum website, or you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for the Innovation Forum podcast. Greenpeace has also been involved in some new research into waste in the UK, alongside countryside charity CPRE and circular economy non-profit WeLoop. The work has shown that more than 8 billion drinks containers were thrown away in the UK in 2019, ending up in landfill, incinerators, or as litter. The containers in the study include those made from glass, PET, other plastics, metals, and wood fibre. The research is designed to help make the case for a wide-ranging deposit return scheme for drinks containers. It points out that in Germany, where there is an efficient deposit return scheme for both single and multi-use containers, the average person wastes just 21 containers a year, compared to 126 in the UK. Of these containers, 40% are made of PET plastic, 33% aluminium cans, and 18% glass. All materials that are likely to be covered by the DRS schemes be considered across the UK. CPRE, previously known as the Campaign to Protect Rural England, has long championed the benefits of an all-in deposit return scheme. The latest report from Oxfam, updating some of the aspects of its well-received 2013-2016 Behind the Brands campaign, assesses whether the world's 10 biggest food and beverage companies have taken meaningful steps to implement the commitments they made in response to the original campaign. The headline finding is that while companies have made high-level global commitments, the devil is in the detail of translating and implementing these at a local country level and for specific supply chains. The Chania Spotlight report concludes that while there are positive examples to address the barriers preventing change at scale, different incentives that support suppliers and so enable that change to happen are required. I'll be talking to one of the Oxfam report's authors in a few days' time, so do listen out for that interview in the coming weeks. The international shipping sector has been criticised for its global carbon impact and the local particulates impact of the bunker fuel typically used by marine engines. An initiative led by a group of governments from nations heavily reliant on shipping would see the creation of a $5 billion research fund to help develop the technology that can lead to widespread zero carbon ships in the future. The ambitious plans, also supported by the International Chamber of Shipping, would raise the funds through a $2 levy on every tonne of shipping fuel used, and have been put in front of the UN International Maritime Organization. Environmental groups, however, say that the move won't go far enough in the context of international maritime trade's share of carbon emissions continuing to grow. The International Maritime Organization faced criticism in 2020 when it gave its approval for emissions to continue to grow for the next decade. Innovation Forum's spring conference season is upon us, opening with the first in our two-part look at the future of food coming up online next week, from the 23rd to the 25th of March. I'll be there and taking part in the various networking events across the 3 days, so do say hi if you're attending. I'd also be delighted to meet with anyone one-on-one using the conference platform's meetings function. Just get in touch. The latest in Innovation Forum's Action Research Programme is the Sustainable Apparel Barometer. To find out more about this, I spoke with Innovation Forum Head of Research, Tania Richard. Welcome to the podcast, Tania.
Thank you, Ian. You're leading on the apparel barometer research. So what are we trying to achieve with this research?
Yeah, so I mean, over the past year, we as an innovation forum have really been trying to reflect on the impact that we as a company have had with the different conferences we've put together every year. With those, we've obviously been able to bring together actors along the full value chain, all different geographies together to discuss these salient business issues. And it's all been done in a very safe environment held under the Chatham House rule to promote that frank, open, honest discussion. With these research projects, what we want to do is build on that work, the reach, the impact we have through these conferences, and reach an even wider audience that spans further than the attendees that join the conferences. The Sustainable Apparel Barometer is one of those projects. It's a year-long project with a research report at the heart of it. The aim of the research is, for one, to share the experiences and insights of organizations working in sustainable apparel and textile supply chains and in varying geographies. We also want to discuss the opportunities in the sector, share examples of programs that can reach scale, as well as uncover the challenges that need to be overcome. And we also want to share practical guidance, develop specific recommendations for action at key stages in the apparel production and manufacturing to try and create sustainable supply chains.
So who's involved?
At the moment, we have confirmed 4 partners joining us for the first iteration of the barometer. We have Textile Exchange, who many know, it's a membership organization at the heart of the industry trying to make supply chains more sustainable. We have APR, Asia Pacific Rayon, one of the biggest viscose producers in the world, operating on principles of sustainability and transparency. We also have US Cotton Trust Protocol. They're an organization aiming to bring quantifiable and verifiable goals and measurement to sustainable cotton production. And last but not least, we have RAP Compliance. They are a nonprofit dedicated to promoting ethical manufacturing through certification and education. All of them, they represent a great range in focus, geographies, expertise, which we look forward to including all in what we're trying to accomplish with this project.
Are there any interesting initial findings that you've got to?
Yeah, at the moment, we're currently talking to experts in the space, ranging from major brands, retailers, suppliers, manufacturers, NGOs, on a range of topics. Well, some interesting ones that I've had recently were centered around topics like regenerative agriculture, a big buzzword overall in the sustainability space, but also in sustainable apparel. Also, the changing relationship between suppliers and brands when looking to reduce scope 3 emissions. And also the social compliance dynamics in factories has been an interesting one. That's some of the phone conversations we've been having, but we're also conducting primary research through surveys with our partners Ipsos, where we're looking at consumer perceptions of the industry, and the findings of that will also be included in the report, which we're looking forward to.
Yes, I'm looking forward to the Ipsos research as well. We've worked with Ipsos for several years now, and we've got really exciting research coming out through this year. Okay, so what's the timetable for the barometer going forwards?
At the moment, as I said, we're currently speaking to industry and project partners, trying to really pinpoint the challenges in the industry that they're facing and develop that practical guidance that can be given to try and solve these. We will then be putting all those insights together into a report, which will be launched in early summer of this year. If you want to be kept up to date, please just get in touch with anyone on the team. And we also have the website, which we'll be updating periodically.
Sure. And so what I'm saying is, if anyone wants to get involved in the research, then they can go to the website, get more information, and find out how to get in touch with any of the team, as you say. Thanks very much indeed. It's a very exciting project, and look forward to hearing more of it across the year. But for now, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ian.
In the latest in a series of interviews with the companies and organisations that partnered with Innovation Forum's first action research project that focused on smallholder farmer resilience, a few days ago I caught up with Guts Martin, Head of Sustainability Implementation at Golden Agri Resources. We talked about the state of play for the palm oil sector and the shifting deforestation risks and the need for acceptance of challenges that is still required.
You, as GAR, were part of the Innovation Accelerator Research Group, which Innovation Forum had put together last year, and you contributed to the report that we published in December. So what were you with the key things that the research uncovered?
I think there were 2 things which I want to highlight, which I really liked in the report. I think the first one, what was thought-provoking, was about the role of the small-scale agents which come after farm to processor or buyer. What's interesting is really that, you know, you always have this impression, oh, these are the negative or the bad people who exploit the farmers. But actually, we don't know a lot about these people. And I think that was a really good insight. what I actually also know is that these people are often quite critical for the functioning of villages in rural Indonesia as a provider of short-term financing and other needs. So I think that was quite interesting that the report looked into these groups. I think we all learned from the report that we need to invest much more time to understand their role. So I think that I liked really a lot. The other thing I liked was really that it was very comprehensively showing that essentially, unfortunately, smallholder farming is a broken system. Yeah, not only in emerging markets, but also if you look in Europe, I think smallholders are facing the same situation. Essentially, they are trapped in a poverty trap because there is a huge disconnect from procurement teams at the buyer side and the sustainability teams. Yeah, and so it's all still about minimum cost, and not connected to sustainability targets. And then I think also very clear spelled out is that essentially due to the lack of coordination, Munkin also due to a bit too much of ego, a lot of donor money, a lot of NGO initiatives, a lot of aid money has really not met its target. Maybe because they didn't understand the smallholder, who is the smallholder, but had some ideas, but you know, it was not implemented properly, not for the right target audience, and also not for scale.
Given all of that then, given the fact that you, as you point out, that in many respects, the smallholder farmer model is broken, can you see a future where smallholder farming communities are viable and sustainable? And if so, what are the key things that have to happen for us to get there?
I hope it can work. It has to work because otherwise the whole food system has a big problem and many rural landscapes have a big problem if we would fail. I think what the winning components are certainly approaches which are around multi-crops, not only one crop. Yeah, a focus on one crop is very dangerous. And so with multi-crops, we could balance out seasonality effects and also avoid of crop failures. That needs a bit training and a bit convincing that they should trial for different crops, which are at the moment not so common. One important insight also from the report for me was new funding models. And I think new funding models also important really to look into the sex of the farmers. I understand that female farmers or women farmers have very different needs than male farmers. So I think the funding needs to be in accordance to the needs. Currently, it's neither nor, but if we think about new funding models, it's good to have that distinction between male and female farmers. I think very important also is really the inclusion of environmental services into the whole business pillar, which is not included at this stage. Procurement teams need to go beyond minimum prices. I think prices need to be fair. I think we also as consumers need to start again to accept non-conform products. If the cucumber is not exactly 25 centimeters long, or if it's not perfectly straight, or if there is a brown touch on the skin, it should still be accepted in the supermarkets and not thrown away. It's a complicated puzzle and a lot of pieces need to fall into the right place, but I truly hope that we can go there. And, you know, I'm excited to continue with your colleagues to talk about, especially also the transparent marketplace. I think that is really what we need. Farmers need to understand when is their crop needed, in what quantities, so that they can also do a bit better planning. And if we achieve that, I think then rural communities can be viable and can start to grow again.
Interested in what you said around the different requirements from male and female farmers. What do male farmers want or require as different from a female-led or a woman-led farm?
I think the difference is that probably both parties will have very much in mind the type of work they are doing. So for men, it might be bigger investments into machinery, or they would always go for higher yields. But sometimes then I understand, for example, women would look more like, if you get higher yields, does that mean you need to cook it longer, or it goes faster in the kitchen, or you can also sell it at a higher price, or you need to sell it at a lower price, while the men would only go for volumes, for example, and therefore would make different choices. So I think that's how you need to understand the different thinking and the different mindset.
More broadly then, how do you characterize the state of play in the palm oil sector? I mean, obviously, prices are high right now. Whilst it's good news in some respects, it also brings in challenges for the sector as well, doesn't it?
I completely agree with the view. I think everyone is quite bullish at the moment. after the long price depressions in the past. I think we see actually a bit of M&A ongoing right now, industry consolidation, which might be positive for the industry from implementation of commitments. But yeah, you are right. In the past couple of years, besides the commitments, it was very clear that at depressed market prices, you just need to do the math. And you see that it's not worthwhile to do new greenfield investments, while now the prices are high enough that companies from a pure financial perspective might consider. And so it will be a big test for the commitment this year. I think on the other side, what I clearly see is that more and more companies are coming to us, GAR, and ask, you know, how about re-engagement? Yeah, how can we start getting back into business? These are all indicators for me that even prices are now up. Everybody is clear that this is a short-term thing, and while commitments to no deforestation and lift the industry to a new level or a higher level is a long-term thing. So these are really indicators that the industry takes on the long-term view is gradually changing.
There must be the ability for the sector to expand production without deforestation. And that's going to be interesting to see if the sector can deliver that. I mean, there will be areas that can be developed. There can be, we talked about yield. I mean, there must be the opportunity for better practices to increase yields using a land that is currently in under plantation and not extending into existing forests. That's going to be the challenge, isn't it, for the sector in the next couple of years?
Yeah, very clear. I think the seedling material, the good, better seedling material is already there. And we will see more and more replanting going forward in the future. I think what will be the challenges, which brings us back to the smallholders, is how will the smallholders get access to these seeds? Because normally they are proprietary knowledge developed by companies. Yeah, GAR is one of them. So that will be the question which we need to work out.
Here's an example of the opportunity for a good news story, isn't it, for the sector? And for too long, palm oil communications have all been about just defensive, trying to put out the news fires, the kind of bad news stories about deforestation, damaging to peat and everything else. So do you think that the sector is still too defensive? I mean, is there a need to perhaps reset the agenda a bit and get on the front foot and talk about some of the good news stories that there are in the palm oil sector?
That's clearly the case. To be honest, I'm proud what I've seen in the past. Yeah, if we look into the latest chain reaction research report that deforestation is essentially now 10% in Malaysia, Indonesia, and PNG combined, 40,000 hectares per year. Obviously, that's still a large area, but it's less than 10% than what it was in the peak, 2007, 8, 9, when I saw statements from people like Glenn Horowitz, for example, who recognized that. And I think it's good for the industry to get that credit. For sure, still work to be done, that's clear. But there are these good stories, how the industry is contributing to SDGs, for example. The replanting for smallholders is a very positive story. And we should be a bit more confident in what has been achieved. Obviously, I think we should not or must not be arrogant in any ways and continue to move forward and push and set us new targets in other spaces. Yeah, I think about greenhouse gases, for example. We need to be keen to move on, but we have been too reactive and too defensive in the communication.
Interesting. You mentioned the deforestation rates in Indonesia. The news came out in that report you mentioned a few weeks ago about the overall rates being down, which was great news. But then, of course, there's always a kind of a caveat, isn't there? The news came out more recently that whilst overall the numbers are looking good and deforestation rates are down in Indonesia, but in fact, in the very sensitive forests of Papua, deforestation rates have spiked significantly where virgin forest is being cleared. That obviously is a contrast there within different parts of Indonesia, but it highlights the fact that knowing the context is very important on data and getting the right data and the right levels of transparency. Is that the sort of level of detail now that the palm oil sector is going to have to tackle?
Obviously, it's clear. Yeah, I think what is also, again, interesting, Global Forest Watch just recently launched, after a 2 years pilot period, a new radar-based satellite monitoring system, which is now freely available for everybody to monitor with radar technology, which means that finally the old cloud disturbed optical images are not used anymore. That will give a new level of detail. Just a word to Papua. Obviously, you know, Papua is a highly political, highly sensitive topic in Indonesia. To be quite honest, if you look into Papua, current forest cover, more than 85%, very low GDP per capita, by far the lowest in Indonesia, high child mortality, low education, very short lifespan. All the economic development plans in the past have failed to bring in the central government and bring them along the journey. the plan B again brings me back to lacking payments for environmental services is still missing. Yeah, because you need to invest into Papua. There is investment needs for healthcare, education, etc., which comes at a cost, and somebody will need to pay for it, as the standing forest is of relatively low value still, or not able to meet the cash needs the province of Papua and West Papua has. I think that would be really a game changer if we move forward towards payment for environmental services.
I think you make a very strong point. I mean, a realistic approach is essential. You have to accept that there are people living there, they have needs and everything else. And payment for environmental services does seem to be a very clear way to allow for sensitive development and acknowledgement of the value that these forests represent, which has been lacking, as you say, for so long. Looking forward then, what do you hope to see more of this year and the next couple of years? What do you think we're going to see and what do you hope to see?
What I hope to see is a step towards more transparency. It's a big discussion about maps in Indonesia, and I hope that we can move forward there and be more transparent. Where are the boundaries, etc.? GAR is working on a system where customers will be able on a platform to verify if deforestation alerts are inside or outside. I hope other companies would follow such an example. Companies need to see that we need viable communities in our surrounding. So we need to invest in these communities through smallholder programs, palm, but obviously also other crops to maintain, to keep them viable, because we simply need them as workforce, we need them as suppliers, etc., stewards of the landscape. And I hope that more and more companies will come along on that journey.
Thanks, Scott. As ever, there's always lots happening in the palm oil sector. And as ever, it does seem to come back to having viable producer communities. Scott Barton from Golden Ag Resources, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you as well.
As ever, look out at innovationforum.co.uk for all the usual audio interviews and insights. And I hope to see many of you at the Future of Food event from the 23rd of March in a few days' time. And there will be reaction and comment from the conference participants over the weeks to come. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.